This is Kevin McDonald, the improv nerd, and you're listening to the improv nerd, but not Kevin McDonald. Yes, you're listening to him now, but I mean you're listening to the bigger project called Improv Nerd. Sorry.
That's improv, bitch. Improv, bitch.
I mean, after all, you're nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Improv.
Nerds.
Hi, I'm Jimmy Corain, and this is a very special episode of Improv Nerd. We're lucky enough to sit down with Kevin McDonald from Kids in the Hall, who talked to us about his first improv class with Mike Myers in Toronto, his relationship with Dave Foley, and the evolution of one of the greatest sketch groups of all time, Kids in the Hall. Kevin McDonald is one of the co-founding members of Kids in the Hall that ran from 1988 to 1995, and it continues to have this huge cult following, attracting a whole new generation of fans. Since 2002, the kids have embarked on a couple tours and created a mini-series for the CBC called Death Comes to Town. He's in Chicago teaching a two-day improv for writing workshop. Kevin McDonald, welcome to Improv Nerd.
Thank you for having me, Improv Nerd. I'm not calling you a nerd. I'm just calling the whole show. Yes.
Thank you.
You're not a nerd in any
I am, Kevin. I am.
You're a beautiful dreamer, but you're not a nerd.
Thank you. Now, you talked openly in your one-man show, Hammy and the Kids, about your abusive alcoholic father.
Yes, I do.
What was that like growing up?
It's funny. First of all, I only talked about it during the show because my dad died, so that was good.
Were you afraid to talk about him when he was still alive?
It's not that I was afraid. I probably would. Maybe I wouldn't have out of respect. It's just that I never got the idea to. It's because I don't know. Maybe I was still... I wouldn't be able to think it was funny. I didn't think it was funny until after he died, for some reason. It's like the first time the Kids in the Hall, we did the sketch Daddy Drank, which got in my one-man show, too. But I went to the office one day, and Dave and our writing partner Norm were there.
Norm Hiscock and Dave Foley.
Sorry, everybody.
Yeah.
I'll stop leaning into the mic. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you don't have to lean into the mic because it's...
I know. I'm sorry. And we were trying to think of sketch ideas, and nothing came up. So we just started telling stories, and I was telling awful stories about my dad, like the 0x0 story that's in that, I'll say it, because my dad really said that. He said, when he got drunk, he'd be mean to me and come in my room and say, "Hey kid, how many girls called you yesterday? Zero? Right, yeah. How many girls called you today? Zero? Right. You know what 0x0 equals, don't you? Fag!" And I was telling these horrible stories, and Dave Foley said, "Hey, you know that could be a sketch." Those weird magic words, and I was horrified with that. A sketch, though, this is horrible. And we wrote it up, and when we brought it to the read-through, the other kids in the hall laughed, and the producers laughed, so it was picked, it was chosen. And then cut to a month later when we're shooting in front of a live audience, and right before the sketch, I started shaking. And the reason I was shaking, not that I was going to show something personal, I'm cool with that, but that I was confident the audience wasn't going to laugh, and they thought they would think I'd be indulgent. And I got afraid for it. Then we did it, and the audience laughed, like laughing bastards. They laughed, and it became like one of the sketches I got quoted the most. But what was your original question? I forget. Oh, growing up, it was my dad. It was like awful. But then when I went into my room after like horrible things would happen, I would inevitably see the comedy in it. And then later, when I got older, like 16, 17, as it was happening, I would see and it was getting way worse. And he would do way worse things.
But what did he do? Way worse stuff. Did he hit you? Did he?
Yeah, he hit, and he choked my mother, and he threw a toaster in my sister's head, and things like that. And
but it was a Canadian toaster, so it wasn't as
exactly
as the ones here in the States.
Thank God it was
it's
Canadian.
It's only one slice.
It was a waffle iron, yeah. So we were okay. And once across the street, he was at a bar, and the bartender said your dad. He called and said your dad's too drunk, and I had to go get him. And all the other drunks taunted me. It was like things like that. But I swear it's funny in my show.
What did you do to escape that when you were growing up?
Well, I would go to my room and I would take my hockey cards. And we had hockey cards. I would like sort of write and act out plays with them. And I would sort of act things. It was sort of like the first kind of sketches I wrote. I remember locking my room and escaping and writing. I remember I wrote my first sketches in there. I wrote a parody of... I've never even, like, children to anybody.
How old are you at this time, would you say?
This is like 17.
Okay.
And I wrote a parody of Psycho, the movie Psycho called Psychosomatic, where it was just a woman in the shower screaming, ow, oh, ow! But it was Psychosomatic. Also, The Odd Schizophrenic, which was the same. I wrote that the same day because it's the same kind of idea, where the instead of Felix and Oscar, the odd couple, there was one guy who was both neat and tidy. Things like that. But that's what I would do. I would go in my room and live in a dream world, which doesn't help me as an adult.
And then around this time, 17, 15, yes. I think maybe around 15, you are starting to take classes, or as you say, up in Canada, workshops right. at the Second City in Toronto. How did you end up there?
Well, actually, I got to the workshops in 19, and what happened was I went to college in Toronto for acting, and not university, college, because you had to go to grade 13. You had to there was in Toronto there was 5 years of high school, but I only wanted to go to 4 years, so I was only entitled for community college, and I went there and for acting, and I was kicked out after 3.5 months, a week after John Lennon died. I was kicked out.
Yeah, but no correlation.
Okay. Well, all right. And I remember the dean of the department. He had one leg, and he limped around telling me that I was a one-legged actor. And I remember thinking the irony in that.
Right.
That I.
What is that term? You're a one-legged actor.
One-legged actor. It means that I was good at a certain thing. Uh-huh. But he didn't think I was good at musical theater or whatever else. I was good at dramatic acting, so I at least had 1.5 legs, I think. But I failed the wardrobe department, and I failed dance. I feel something else. But as I was being kicked out that day, as I was sadly walking to my bus, I had to take 3 buses, 1 subway, 2 buses to get back home to the suburb where I lived outside of Toronto, the improv teacher ran after me, and he said that I was good at improv and that I should keep it up. And he had written down the phone number of Second City Workshops, and he gave it to me. And that was my one hope on the bus ride. I had one glimmer of hope. That would do the Second City. I always thought Second City, I'd go in and be taught by John Candy because I was a SCTV fan then. And this is an interesting sidebar. The teacher who did that, gave it to me, was William Davis, and he played the smoking man in X-Files years later.
Because it was filmed up
in Canada. Yeah.
So then you go to Second City, yes. And you're amongst this, it's you and another teenager,
yes.
And it's all like 30-year-old people who want to be actors. Who was the other teenager in that first class?
The other teenager was I was 19, he was 17, was a young man by the name of Mike Myers. And I was telling the class today how Mike and we gravitated to each other right away. We knew each other were funny right away. And but the first 2 or 3 classes, we never volunteered. We were like just funny in the corner. And it was a 6-week session. And I remember Mike, by the 3rd or 4th week, Mike said to me, "You know, Kevin, we paid a fortune to be in this workshop, $60. And I think, you know, we should start volunteering. And I remember the scene that he did. It was a scene where you had to use objects to advance the story and by yourself. And I just remember being upstairs and opening drawers and instead of underwear, finding a gun and doing something funny with a gun. I remember laughing. I was 19 and I grew up in a suburb outside of Toronto, Mississauga. And I had this gunfighter theory of comedy. And I thought that I was, to that point in my life, I was the fastest gunfighter. And no one was funnier than me. And when I saw Mike Myers for the first time ever, I thought, I just met someone live, like not on TV, but someone like live in person who might be funnier than me. I'm thinking that.
And then you guys become good friends.
We were like, we even started like a troupe that we never got past the first rehearsal.
What happened?
I don't know. A couple things. The teacher saw that we were good, and he was looking for a sketch troupe for his girlfriend, who was also very good.
Uh-huh.
And so we went to his house somewhere in Toronto. And talked about it. I guess we went a couple of times to write and rehearse, and nothing ever gelled. And Mike was just too ambitious. He, I know what happened. Like a few weeks after that, he was hired by Second City.
You know, I knew Mike a little here in working at the Improv Olympic when he came up and then did Second City Main Stage. He was so, you say ambitious, he was so focused. Was he even focused back then?
Oh, yeah. He was so ambitious and so driven. He was like the kids in the hall. There were like 12 or 13 of us, and at one point it was 4 of us. Mark, Bruce, Dave, and I.
Before Scott Thomas.
Yes, before Scott. There were 4 of us, and for some reason Mark was obsessed with getting a 5th one, and Dave and I kept getting Mike Myers to come do our stage shows. This is when we were just a stage troupe, and Dave and I wanted it to be Mike. but Mark and Bruce were against it. They thought that the Mike Myers area was covered by Dave and I.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think Mike would have joined anyway, because he was thinking something else. He moved to England anyway.
He had a comedy partner, as I remember.
Yeah, he went to England and met Neil Mullarkey.
I think so.
And Mullarkey and Myers, or Myers and Mullarkey? Mullarkey and Myers. They, yeah, I saw the show because they came in and did it in Toronto. It was really good, really clever. Super clever and super funny. It was great, actually. And yeah, I bring it to Mullarkey Myers. Sort of became a semi-big thing in London. Then called Second City and said, I want to come back. And I think he made main stage first in Chicago. I don't even know if he did main stage in Toronto, did he? Did he go straight to Chicago? He did the Touring Company in Toronto. And then he went to England. And then he went to Chicago, I think.
I'm not certain on that. We'll have to check. Ben, our producer,
when we interview Mike Myers, we'll let you know.
So then, you then continue to take workshops, and you meet Dave Foley.
A year after Mike, I met Dave.
And you said that he made you laugh during a mirror exercise. Now, I teach improv. I don't think that's the objective is to have to have them laugh. What kind of student were you back then, improv student?
I was like funny, very funny, but sometimes at the expense of the improv. But like,
was it more important for you to be funny than to learn the craft?
Yeah, it was, but it was more important to learn the craft, but it was also important for me to learn the craft. So I did learn the craft. I wasn't ignoring the craft totally, but it was I think more important for me to be funny. But the teachers never seemed to mind for some reason. Now Dave, he could actually be funny while doing the craft, though he also liked to break the fourth wall and things like that too. But he could also like just dig in, like he didn't need to do the cheap tricks that him and I did all the time. He could actually just get laughs within the confines and structure of pure improv.
And then at this point, you asked Dave to join your group. Was there an actual group?
No, there was a guy named Luch that I knew I wanted to work with. And I asked at the end, yeah, because we did the mirror exercise at the beginning of the workshop. We did I'm miming doing the mirror.
Right.
And you're not supposed to, like, it's not supposed to be funny. You're not even on stage. You just spread out. Everyone's in groups of twos, and you're spread out around the class doing it.
It was a Spolin exercise, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly. But we kept going down till we were lying on the floor in the fetal position. And right away, I thought he was funny. And then at the end of the class, we were split into three groups. And he was like the funniest guy in his group. And
now I see Dave like making fun of the mirror exercise.
Yeah, that's what is sort of happening. Yeah. Yeah. But we were still doing it. We were still
Each other. But kind of like wink, wink, nod, nod. Look, you know.
Yeah, yeah. No, look at sure. this. For sure. But right away, it seemed like we had chemistry. And then when I saw him do this improv that he was so funny in, he also reminded me a little bit of Mike.
Uh-huh.
So I could have made a mistake. It could have just been that he reminded me of Mike. But I don't think so. I think that soon, by the end of the class, soon, no, he's funny. He has great timing. He's a joke machine. He was a bit like Woody Allen, which I was too, but in a different way, different thing than Woody Allen does. And it just seemed that we had chemistry, and so I asked him to join my troupe, and I didn't know his name.
So you guys are doing improv shows around Toronto.
Yes,
right?
Dave Luch and I, the original.
Now, what happened to Dave Luch? I almost felt like he was Pete Best of Kids in the Hall. Whatever happened to
him? Luch, he's actually great. You always hear that, like Lenny Bruce. Who's the guy, Lenny Bruce? He's actually funnier than Lenny and inspired him.
Right.
Like,
or they say about Michael Jordan's brother was
a better
player.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he was actually great, and he came up with a lot of great ideas. And now he is like a great hardworking writer in Canada. Like, he writes on all the comedy shows. But back then, the three of us, like, we did have great chemistry and were great. But I think he suffered from stage fright. And one night, with the guys from Calgary, Mark and Bruce and others, they joined the troupe. That's when there were seven or eight of us. There were a lot of us.
So Kids in the Hall, there was seven or eight originally?
Oh, yeah. There was different. Because okay. There was Dave Luch and I. And then there were the five guys from Calgary, which Mark and Bruce were part of.
Uh-huh. The audience.
The audience.
Okay.
Exactly. You've done your research.
Yeah.
And so there were a lot of us. And after one show, Luch came back and said, I quit. I don't want to go on stage anymore. I'm starting theater production at university next year, and I don't think I can do it.
What was your reaction? Cause
he was like, understand that I never had a girlfriend until I was like 22 or 23. And this was when I was 21 or 22. And I had friends in high school, but Luch was my first, he was almost like a girlfriend. We called each other on the phone every night.
Mm-hmm.
This was before cell phones. We just, the phone with the long cords. We phoned him every night. I'd be on the phone, like, and I try to see him all the time. And Dave and I were close too, but I had known Luch before Dave, and it was like devastating. I always thought we'd get a TV show, But I just always assumed Lutz would be there. So it was, I didn't understand it. It was devastating, and we sort of never been a close, as close ever since. I probably was an immature 21-year-old, and hopefully I'm a mature 74-year-old now. But still, the root, the pattern was set back, was set in back then. And
you so look great for 74, by the way.
I know, that's why it's good that I lie about my age.
So then, Mark and Bruce join you because they come to Toronto and they've got their group, The Audience.
Yes.
And it's a competing group. How do you decide to join forces?
Well, yeah, it's funny because there was Theater Sports, which is like
a problem. John Stone's.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Theater, and there was one in Toronto. It started in Calgary. The big thing was in Calgary, even though Toronto's a bigger city. So we, the kids in Hull, which are Dave Lutch and I, we got a reputation for Theater Sports for being the different group, the weird group. We wouldn't win the games, but like we'd do weird things like we'd lose on purpose. Because you got a zero, and we'd go get the judge a zero, and we'd pull it up. And then like it was just the comedy that we cared about. And then we started hearing there was a group in Calgary called The Audience. There were five of them, but they were a lot like us in spirit. And we should meet them. And then in 83 was the great Calgary Exodus, where all these artists, comedians, musicians, including the Shadowy Men that did our music later, like writers and poets and just people who were following the Exodus who weren't even in the arts, came to Toronto. And we were introduced right away, and it was like love at first sight for the comedy troops. But it was competitive at first. I remember saying things to Dave like, "Mark's not funny. I could tell, look at the way he gets changed to the box office of the movie theater. That's not funny. I'd get changed much funnier than that." But because they were a couple years older and more experienced, because they were doing their own shows in Calgary, and we were like just starting, the three of us, they rented theater spaces and did their own shows. And they knew we were good, so they got us to be like featured players in their shows at Saturday Night Live. And slowly it evolved that we were like equals with them.
And then how does Scott Thompson, it's been said, either you or Dave said this, that when Thompson joins the group, things start to solidify with his presence. What changes by adding him?
I said that. Yeah. First of all, like he was in Theater Sports, and Mark just thought he would be something the troupe didn't have.
But he's coming from an acting background, right?
Yeah, and that's why Dave and I were prejudiced against him, because we were prejudiced against actors doing comedy.
I can relate, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, now, like, then in the 80s, Tom Hanks happened, and he could do comedy as well as anyone. Like, we were really prejudiced, and we didn't want him in the group, and Scott would always say, "It's because I'm gay, isn't it?" And we said, no, it's because you're an actor.
Right.
And you say, "Breeders!" That was this big heterosexual one, so. And things changed, but he wore us down. And I remember once he did an improv with me. Like, he was just coming to the shows anyway. Mark wanted him. Bruce didn't care. Dave and I were against it. And then it seemed like he was in the show one night when he did an improv with me that was really good. We were both started to just go for laughs, but we did the rules of improv, and we got our laughs, and it was good. And then Dave and I took him to the alley, and we started singing him. Our theme song at that time as a stage act was The Kids Are All Right.
Mm-hmm.
So we started singing, "The Kids Are All Right." And he knew that meant that he was in the troupe, and he started crying, and then that he was officially in. And what he brought, because he was an actor, I mean, the four kids in the hall, we were almost like writers who forced ourselves to perform at first. And we spent a lot of the time back, like at the back of the stage. Sometimes our backs would be turned to the audience. You hear that?
Like, barely, you could be barely heard.
Barely heard and barely seen.
"We don't really want to be here."
Yeah, exactly. It's, we have clever ideas. Right, you can hear them. Yeah. And I think it was like the Ramones' first concerts. I heard they were like that. We were like that. And Scott literally forced us to the front of the stage and by example, taught us presence, stage presence. And he was really the one that sort of, in a way, said to the audience, "Come to us. We have something special we want to show you." And the audience, like, spiritually and metaphorically leaned in. And I really do think things gelled. Well, they did. That's when we started getting an audience, when it became the five of us.
And then in 1985, McKinney and Bruce...
Yes.
Get hired to write for Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
Now, this is 3 years before you get the pilot.
Yes.
How did you keep the group together?
Yeah, we thought it was done because we were discovered, because we did a Best of Show in Toronto after a year of building up our cult status in Toronto. And
what does cult status mean in Toronto?
It means sold out audiences of 80 people.
Okay.
It was 160, but 80 sounded funnier.
Yeah.
And so we were discovered by someone that learned Michael Sen, because that was the year he started Saturday Night Live again, because he had taken 5 years off of Saturday Night Live. And so we were discovered, but then they could only hire two of us, and they hired the two most experienced ones. And Bruce is the best writer anyway. And
Bruce seems like he's all business too.
Bruce is very all business. Well, this
he comes from a wealthy background. Does that help?
He doesn't know. It's Mark that comes
Mark
from the wealthy.
Does. Okay.
Mark comes from the wealthy.
But they both seem like they're the academics in the group.
Yeah, Dave would also seem like that too if you spoke to him. Scott and I wouldn't seem like that. Though Scott is the only academic in the
right.
I mean, he's the only one with a degree. But I would say that Mark and Dave and Bruce would seem like intellectuals if you've talked to him. Not Scott and I.
So they go and they write for Saturday Night
They write for Saturday Night Live, and we thought it was over, but this was the wonderful thing they did. Saturday Night Live, you do 3 weeks, and then you get a week off.
Right.
And they, in their weeks off, they came to Toronto. They didn't rest, and we kept doing shows at the Rivoli. And some of our sketches that became our signature sketches were written during that year, during those weeks off, like Dr. Seuss Bible, and Salty Ham and Cabbage Head, and Citizen Kane. And so it sort of became, even though it was instead of every week, it was once every 3 weeks or 4 weeks, the audiences were bigger than ever. We had to turn people away because two of us were starting our live. And that's when we started getting interest for TV shows. And we went through a few producers, and finally they didn't gel until Lauren Michaels said, well, I should just do a TV show with them. That's why Mark and Bruce weren't asked back the next season of Saturday Night Live, because that's when we started sort of working on a TV pilot, though it took a couple years.
One of my all-time favorite sketches is The King of Broken Promises.
Yes, yes.
For the people who are younger and haven't seen it, can you just describe it?
Yeah.
They're going to YouTube it, let's hope it.
Yeah, one day Norm and I, we wrote a lot of sketches Hiscock. Together. Norm Hiscock, who is on Parks and Rec right now.
That's what he's writing in.
Yeah, yeah. And he said, you know, Kim, we should do a sketch about how you always promise people things, but you never come through.
And so it was based on you.
Yeah, a little bit. And I always mean it at the time. I always get excited and say, oh, yeah. And then like an hour later, I forget. And they, oh, weren't you going to get that guy, that CD? No, I don't remember saying that. So we wrote the sketch. It's one of those things we knew the premise. We knew the character. And then we sat on the computer before we knew any of the structure. And it just flowed out? Flew out? Flew out sounds bad. It was flowing out, and then we had it written in like less than an hour, and then we read it and it seemed funny, and I said, but Norm, it seems like I can't do it like myself. It should be like a character that sort of suggests evil in a non-evil way. And then I thought, Paul Bellini, Scott's writing partner, you know, the Touch Bellini guy, the guy in the towel. Do you remember the Touch Bellini contest where he's the guy in the towel that we poke with a stick?
No, do you, Ben?
Yes. Well,
yeah.
He's Scott's writing partner.
Okay.
And he has this way of talking. And I said, I think I should do it like how Bellini talks. And that's how Bellini talks. So instead of going, we'll do, I started doing like Bellini, which is, we'll do. Slipped my mind. Because every time you'd hear Scott and Bellini write, it was mostly Scott dictating. And or sometimes Scott would suggest a joke, and you hear Bellini, from their cubicle, you hear Bellini go, no, Thompson, I'm not writing that, it's shit. To which Scott's writing reply would be, yeah, Bellini, well, you're fat, so write it. You can assault me all you want, Thompson. I'm not writing it. So I thought that was like a good guy. And he doesn't really speak like that, but that's how I do him. And that's how I was doing around the office that year. And so we read the script, like that character, and it seemed to work perfectly.
It was just great. And I don't know who I felt more sorry for. Foley was the kid, right?
Yeah.
I don't know if your kid, because I could relate, because I was like that as a kid,
yeah.
Or the kid who believed that the person was actually going to come through on the promises.
Yeah. I probably feel sorry for Dave. And that's the other thing with Dave. We wrote him just to do it totally normal, and we didn't know that he'd got this elaborate wig and teeth thing, and he was doing it like a weird cartoon character. And so when we first started the sketch, I was worried that, oh, we're both two cartoons, it's not going to work. But and then as soon as we start acting, it's, oh yeah, Dave knows what he's doing. It totally works.
You know, the thing I loved about Kids in the Hall, and it was funny because you talked about the jealousy, because I remember when you guys first came on, people are like, the first couple of, oh, they're not funny. You know, because you know how that, you know how comedy people are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're not funny. Yeah, they're not funny. Yeah, you know, because we were all comedy snobs. And then
it grows on you.
It grows on you, and you're like, but I heard you said that really you have to watch it a couple times to get it.
Yeah, I think so. I think when I was a kid watching Monty Python, it was unlike anything. Like, I like Carol Burnett and Sid Caesar and stuff, but it was unlike anything that I did. I wasn't old enough to, like, ever heard The Goon Show or anything like that. And even from The Goon Show, they advanced it so much. So, to me, it was really weird and strange, and I didn't get it, but I knew there was something special about it. I knew there was something worthwhile. I knew something different was happening. So So that's what made me watch it again. So like you're saying, when people watch the Kitson Hall, don't get it the first time, but they have to watch it two or three times. What made them watch it the second or third time? There's just something there that they know. Like a great song that you need three times to hear before you know it's a great song, like that.
Well, I think the other thing is that I loved about your show was, after I got over the jealousy and you know, said, okay, these guys are great, was even when it wasn't funny, you're like, I've never seen that on television before.
Right.
You guys would take these risks. And how important was putting a sketch on, even if it wasn't funny, just for the sake that it was weird, that you needed to do that to be overall to be the funny quotient.
Well, the thing is, there was like, there's two trains of thought.
That's my phone. So, yeah.
There's two trains of thought. I was going to ignore it. I was going to be a professional.
Yeah. We use everything.
There were two trains of thoughts in the group. And there was always a, sometimes there was always like a comedy argument. Whereas.
That's my phone, and it's going off. I feel a lot of shame about that. Okay, go on.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no.
Should I call you?
Okay. There's two
thoughts. There's two trains of thought. And one is represented by Dave and I, mostly Dave.
Mm-hmm.
And one's represented by Bruce and Mark. And in a way, sometimes mostly Bruce, sometimes mostly Mark. Dave and I wanted just everything to be funny all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce and Mark sometimes would go more for feeling and weirdness. Like, so I think the scene, I don't know if you're referring to it directly, but the scene that represents what you're saying the most is Love and Sausages, the mm-hmm. sausages scene. And that Norm wrote it for me,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote the beard for Bruce. And Bruce said, can I do sausages? I'd like to rewrite it. I know what to do with it. And Norm came to me and said, do you mind giving Bruce sausages? And I was in a bad mood. I said, no, but he's got to give me the beard, which is like, unlike me. I remember Norm being shocked. So we switched. But anyway, sausages... was always a fight from not so much me, because I don't mind feeling something. I think it's part of the troupe. I think it represents part of the troupe. We're gonna have like seven sketches an episode, and why can't one be like sausages? There's gonna be like five or six that we're at least going for gag fest. So, but Dave was more protective of that. Like all the time, he wanted to be gag fest, and so he fought against it, but he knew to give up. And even our director John Blanchard, who was also SCTV director, he didn't direct that film, but he was the producer of the show that time, and he fought against it. But we picked it, we chose it, we did it. And when you think about it, it's not a laugh a minute, or a laugh a second riot. It's the only thing that's technically funny in it is Scott is the grandfather saying, sausages, sausages. And that's like a performance thing. But just the fact that people talk about it still 20 years after and the feel of it, like sometimes I think it could have been our movie. We'd have to put more jokes into it. But yeah, it definitely represents a valid part of the brain that is the Kids in the Hall. And I'm so glad that we did it.
Let's talk about the movie, Brain Candy.
Yes.
Which was a very stressful time for you and the group.
Yes.
And your friendship with Dave Foley.
Yes.
He's doing news radio during that time. And he decides to quit.
Yes.
The movie. Why does he leave?
He leaves. Well, there's a few things that are happening. It was a horrible time for the troupe. Some of us in our family, there were like two suicides in the troupe's families. And
well, you guys all come pretty much from, except for Bruce, right? Come from a alcoholic, dysfunctional family.
White trash trouble, we like to call it. We come basically, except for Mark, white trash trouble. And my mother wouldn't hate that. Though she's dead, so I'm not saying she's not white trash. Yeah. And there were like two of us had our wives leave us, and it was hard because we were writing for the first time, all of us writing together in the same room with Norm, and that was really hard. Usually we split up in groups, or in the old days when we were a club act, we wrote together in a different, we didn't write it down, we did what I'm doing in this workshop, we improvised it till we had it, but we were at a computer writing, and it was very difficult.
And you wrote a letter, you were upset at Dave. So you write him a letter.
Yeah, because Dave was in news radio, and he wanted to delay our movie, Brain Candy, a year so he could do his movie, The Wrong Guy, which is a very funny movie. And I thought, because he said the Brain Candy wasn't ready yet, the script wasn't ready yet. And I thought, knowing the kids in the hall, we delayed a year, we're not going to do Brain Candy. We'll all be on other projects, and we'll be done. So I realized later, speaking of jealousy, that I was partly motivated by jealousy of Dave, that he was getting news radio, that he was so good, that he was on his way becoming a Hollywood star.
I had heard too, now tell me, this is
from people. I'll hear the truth.
Okay, thank you, I appreciate that. Dave, everybody in Toronto knew that Dave wanted to be a star.
Oh, I didn't know that. I don't know about that.
Not that it's a... I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's a good thing.
I mean, at that time, he was driven... Like, him and his wife at the time were sort of, like, being smart about it. Like, going to Hollywood and going to the right parties. Uh-huh. But no, I would say that was more like Mike.
Myers.
Yeah, like in a good way. Like, Mike was really smart about it and did mm-hmm. it. And I'm more like a sloth. Thank God I was in a group of four guys who were, like, ambitious. Mm-hmm. But I never, like, thought of it that way with Dave. I mean, he was driven to that point. And he was working very hard to, like, become successful in a place other than Canada. Mm-hmm. In Hollywood, for sure. And
so you write him this letter.
I wrote him this letter, and I forget what it was about, but it was emotional, about how he was hurting the troop and stuff
and
like that.
And you also said that he was making some choices that weren't helping the group, that was hurting the group.
Right. Well, the biggest one was, like, not wanting to do Brain Candy, mm-hmm. like wanting to delay so he could do his movie. And so at a troop writers meeting, I said, Dave, read this letter. I don't know why I wanted him to read it out loud. It was crazy of me. And he said, I refuse to read this letter. I said, okay, go away and read this letter. He said, no, I'm never going to read this letter. And then I forget, I blocked it out, but I said something, probably horrible, that led Dave to say, that's it, I quit the troop. And he did, he quit the troop.
Did you feel responsible?
Oh, totally. Well, I was. Well, I think Dave was looking for a way to quit the troop, and I gave him a beautiful, like, way to do it. Because he wasn't happy with the troop. Yeah, and this one time where the two part of the factions of the group weren't working together, I moved to the other faction because I wasn't agreeing with how Dave thought Brain Candy would go. I forget what it was like. He wanted more like Holy Grail, that was
the
more,
comedy,
less story. I love Holy Grail. And I in retrospect, I think we should have done a movie like that, but the movie that we committed to working on, Brain Candy, wasn't that movie. It was a movie with a story. So I wanted to do this particular project that we were working on. I thought we should do it the way that it deserved to be done. And so Dave quit the troop. And unfortunately for him, he had already signed the contract before he quit the troop. So he had to do Brain Candy. But he didn't write anymore. And you could I love Brain Candy. But you could, if you're a Kid in the Hall fan, or if you're a Kid in the Hall, you know that it suffers from Dave not writing. It just needed those jokes for sure. And also, when Dave came back, he didn't do very much, so he basically played guys in suits, and he had straight parts, and he could have, like... he should have been the lead. Dave was going to be the lead. We always thought Dave would be the lead, just like he was in News Radio, sort of being the straight guy who can get laughs.
The craziness.
Yeah, exactly. But he'd be much better getting laughs while doing that. I did it because no one else... I was the only one that could do it, but it would have been a completely different and funnier movie if I did characters, like the Will Do guy or whatever. And though it would have been different, it wouldn't have been that one. And Dave did the lead, I think.
So he comes back to do it, and your his manager, which is also your manager, says...
Yeah, he says, Dave's going to do it, but he had to do it. But he has some restrictions. He won't play women. And there was a few things, but of course the thing I remember the most was... and Kevin's not allowed to talk to him and try to work it out with him on set, because that's what I do.
Like, is that what you're known for, to work stuff out? Where does that come from? Because you wouldn't think someone who came from an alcoholic household, unless they...
Oh, well, it's not so positive as I'm making it sound. It's not like I want to work stuff out. I want to, like, beat it to death and worry it and talk it. I guess my heart's in the right place. I want to deal with it. But I'm pretty irritating and a pesty on the way. I wish I could do it as healthy as it sounds. But it's more about being a child of an alcoholic. Well, let's talk about it now. Let's do it now. I don't want to wait till tomorrow. Uh-huh. Where Dad may hit me with the fridge. I want to deal with it now.
Are you kind of a guy who wants to resolve it right there?
Well, I can go two ways. Because I'm partly Gemini, I can go two ways. I either want to deal with it right now, or I want to avoid it for 20 years.
So 5 years later, you patch things up with Dave.
Oh, not even. It was way sooner than that.
Okay.
It was like a few years later we did the tour. But... It was before even the movie was released, Brain Candy. Mm-hmm.
How did you patch things up?
It all started from Dave. I was so shy, I wanted to patch things up desperately.
Were you mad at him?
I was not mad at him. I realized at that point that I was jealous.
Okay, how'd you come to that realization?
It just slowly dawned on me by the fact that everybody was talking about how good News Radio was, and I realized that I wasn't watching it, which is really weird. That my, like, best friend was, like, in a TV show on NBC that I wasn't watching.
I just threw my TV out. With all my friends, I just threw my TV out and just was in denial why I did it.
And also I realized a few years earlier, when Mark was nominated for an ACE Award for Best Actor, I remember being really depressed after, and then I realized jealous of my friend's successes, and all my friends are really, really successful. So I have to end that right now. Even for selfish reasons, it will cripple me inside, and I will get stomach cancer. And so I can't do this with everything in my life, but I just stopped it. And I stopped it right before Dave called me. I'd he'd been living in L.A. to do his TV show, News Radio. And I was there slowly moving, but I was renting a condo. I saw the house in Toronto. And he knew I was there, and he got my phone number from somebody, and he called me. And I remember there was a hockey game on, but I was in the bath. And then he called and said, I heard you're only a few blocks away. I heard you're in Hollywood. Yeah, do you want to come down tonight? You want to see X-Files in my house? I said, oh, sure, I'd like to see that. And that was the beginning of patching up. And later I found out he was in the bath, so we patched up naked and wet.
Mm. Now, was this one of these times where you wanted to resolve it and talked about it? Or was this one of these things, let's talk about it 20 years down the road?
Let's talk about it 20 years down the road. We just came in and we made jokes like the old days, and we talked about X-Files, and a few of his friends came over, and introduced him, and we had like a good fun time. And then his friends went away, and him and I went to a record store. I remember I told him to buy the Big Star CD because he hadn't bought Big Star, and I wanted to get into that. And I also remember thinking, wow, this is opposite of the Dave I knew like 10 years earlier, because he was working on a network show and he bought like 30 CDs. And like, he's, oh, I heard this is great. Oh, I like the cover of this one. And, we just started being friends again. And every now and then when we're like, on tours, alone in the bus, a little drunk or something, we talk about it, and he knows that I know that I was jealous, and he felt betrayed. And he told me that one day. I think it was in Dallas or Houston, and we talk about it every 3 years.
Now, you had also said in your show that you compared the kids in the hall to your family, and you said they were very dysfunctional, both of them.
Yes,
it's obvious your family was very dysfunctional with your father. What was dysfunctional of in that time in, you know, the 80s and the 90s when you guys had the show? What was dysfunctional about the group?
Oh, like everything. And I'm sure that was part of my attraction. And now, as an adult who's trying to be totally functional, I think we should all, I would love to just get everyone more like normal human beings and have things work right. It was, you know, we fought for no reason, or even when we fought for good reasons, it was ugly. Like, we were like best friends who happened to be in a comedy troupe.
Was there drugs and drinking? I would imagine, because you guys came from alcoholic backgrounds, there had to be drugs and drinking in the group.
No, there wasn't really. There was like norm. Like back then, there was like I never did drugs, and I some members did like normally, but it was never about that. It was not like a rock and roll band. Mm-hmm. It was like it wasn't like anything like a problem at all. Mm-hmm. I didn't even drink till I was 26, mm-hmm. And Mark and Scott don't drink a lot at all. And
is that a are like you that. Kidding or
no? That's true. It's true. Okay. It's what am I saying about the other two? And it's like there was never like it was never like about oh. Someone's drinking, it's a problem like that at all. And like, there were never any girls around. it was nothing like that at all.
So you guys were like total nerds, right?
Yeah, that's what I think. That's the way I remember it for sure. There were, I was girlfriendless, so I was 23. There were never groupies ever. ever. We were young. There were, I guess when you would want, there was never anything like that. No sex, drugs, and rock and roll whatsoever. Just guys, nerdy guys pushing their glasses up, going to comedy, then going to the library after.
Now, I watched an interview that you guys had done for CBC when your miniseries came out.
Yes.
And it was so nice to watch you guys just interacting with each other, because it seems like now you really enjoy each other's company. Right. Is that...
Yeah. Now we always enjoyed it, but now all the negative things are out of the way, so we just have the enjoyment. So the whole picture is just enjoyment now. And I think, you know the rock band Camper Van Beethoven?
No.
Well, they were a band in the 80s. And
can YouTube that, I'm sure.
Yes, Camper Van Beethoven. Their best album, in my opinion, is Our Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart. And they...
where he went in to form Cracker.
Yeah, and Cracker. That's right, Cracker. He became Cracker.
Thank you, Ben.
That's right. And they have a new Cracker, a new Camper Van. Well, not new. It's been a few years. Anyway, they apparently fought a lot. And then when they got back together in the... I guess 5 or 6 years ago, they asked about that, and they said, we don't fight anymore. When you're in your 20s and you're in a group of men working together, it's your job to be an asshole. But now, in our 40s, it's our job not to be an asshole.
But isn't there also this thing of, like, when you start out, there's this, I want to be famous, I want to hit it, I want to get big.
Yeah.
And then you realize, the older you get, that this is such a hard business.
Yeah.
And, you know, Dave was on news radio, you know, at one time. It just changes, so...
Yeah, it's cyclical, for sure.
Yeah.
You get more mature about it, and you understand it. And also... We are closer to the end than the beginning, mm-hmm. so there's less pressure.
Right.
Like, I still think the big thing that I'm going to do away from the kids and all I haven't done yet. Well, obviously, because I haven't. I still think that's coming. So I still have the Eye of the Tiger, as Rocky Balboa would say. But there's less pressure. I can't believe I'm going to say this phrase. I've been in this business for 30 years. And so just being in it and knowing what it, you're right, the ups and downs... there's less pressure. And also, like Saturday Night Live, they auditioned for a show, and so of course they would fight for more time and more space. When the Kids in the Hall fought, it wasn't for that so much as it was taking things personal. Well, why don't you like my sketch? Why are you trying to hurt my sketch? I wouldn't cut that. And because we were friends, it sort of hurt more probably than the Saturday Night Live argument would.
And what now you're teaching. And tell us, you're teaching improv for writing.
Yes.
And so are you, what's so funny about that?
Because I'm not really an improviser.
Well, I heard that you don't even consider yourself a good improviser.
No, I that's correct. I think I'm funny during improv.
Which is different but being a good improviser.
Yeah. I think I'm funny. And nowadays when I improv, sometimes I do improv shows with the guys taking my, the guys and gals taking my workshop. I because I've been teaching and I've been seeing them do it so well all day, I can sort of stick by the rules. but the reason I'm teaching is because that's how the Kitson Hall wrote. So I do feel very experienced in writing through improv. And because we didn't do it in front of a live audience, we wrote, only it wasn't with computers. We stood up and we improvised in front of each other until we, that's how we wrote. So it is writing through improv.
So you're sharing them your process that you did.
Yes.
Okay. What is your relationship with now with improv?
That's a good question. Like before this workshop, I would say I don't have any, and but that wouldn't be true because I'm realizing through this workshop I always do. Even when I'm writing alone and I'm by my computer, I'm really improvising in my head, and I mean that's how you write. Like. You imagine the people talking and what they say in the dialogue. And I think that's made stronger because all the years of improv. Like, we improvise forever. As much as I knock myself as an improviser, when the audience came to Toronto, they came with, great scenes that were written. And the thought was the Kids in the Hall were better improvisers and the audience were better writers. And we got so much laughs during improvs that maybe that means we were good improvisers. And I say Dave and then later Mark were technically good improvisers as well. I've improvised 100 million hours. It's definitely got into my system and it comes out in writing and performing for sure.
And how long have you been teaching?
This 6 months.
And what are you getting out of teaching versus performing?
It's funny. It's making me realize how much I love sketch comedy, and it's making me email the Kids in the Hall more because we're trying to get together. And usually it's Bruce that motivates and try to get this together, but it's making me miss the Kids in the Hall even more. So I'm the one like trying to motivate and get everyone together because I feel desperate need to do something.
You're in Winnipeg now, right?
I am in Winnipeg. I've been there for a couple years.
Is Scott still in Toronto?
Scott's in Toronto. Mark's in Toronto. Bruce and Dave are in LA.
Is there anything planned for the Kids in the Hall?
We're having meetings about what we should have meetings about.
Great. You'll let me know if anything.
I will let you know.
Great.
We'll do.
Great. Kevin McDonald, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
You have very good questions.
Thank you.
I called you good questions. You have very good questions.
Great. Thank you so much.
You're very good questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was great.
That was really fun. I liked it.
Improv Nerd. Competition.
I want to thank Kevin McDonald for giving us some of his time. We recorded this at the CIC in Chicago. I want to thank, as always, my producer, Ben Caprero. And please, 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 like Improv Nerd on Facebook. For more information about the Artist Low Comedy classes and workshops, which is a winner of the Innie Award for Best Classes and Workshops, go to jimmycorain.com. Thanks for listening, and until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Improv.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh my